All right.
I like that it
Welcome
lets me
back.
leave the meeting when. Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, you get the option to
Yeah,
leave.
it says, "Oh no, you're being recorded. Now it's time to leave."
Well, you should have availed yourself of that option. It left me here feeling rather silly. Welcome back to The Same But Worse. I'm glad to be back. This is Marshall Steinbaum, and I'm here with.
I'm Andrew Hart, and we're here to talk about a piece that Marshall just wrote. And Marshall, why don't you just take it away with a little summary about your excellent piece?
Well, thank you, Andrew. I appreciate that superlative. So this is called Should Higher Education Ratify Privilege or Public Service in LPE Blog. The basic premise of this is to locate the culture war over higher education and campus politics in a material basis. So, why is there so much drama going on about higher education, seemingly like well outside actual campuses? I mean, there has been a good deal of protests on college campuses in the last couple of months or years, but it seems like there's a lot more hand-wringing about what's going on college campuses in Congress and in the media and, kind of in public debate and on New York Times op-ed pages than is, kind of warranted by the actual importance of what happens in college. And I speak as a university professor myself. So the question is basically, why is that happening? And the answer that I'm putting forward in this piece is basically, anxiety over social reproduction. And this comes in sort of two forms. One is the social hierarchy is basically good and well and is threatened by the idea of, kind of the rabble encroaching on the rarefied precincts wherein the social hierarchy is established. So you've got a lot of people very concerned, for example, about affirmative action permitting the undesirables onto elite college campuses. All of the drama that's happened in the last years regarding the administration at Harvard and Penn and Columbia and so on is clearly premised on, by or kind of downstream from elite, billionaires and also not billionaire, non-billionaire elites, sub-billionaire elites, who feel like these spaces that belong to them are no longer theirs and have been somehow subverted. And this has definitely played a part in the backlash to the 2020 racial justice protests. So I think we're, it's fair to say we're well in the backlash phase of those racial justice protests, and a lot of the anger and dissatisfaction, so to speak, in the elite media and in Congress is coming from this idea that college campuses is where this like threat to the social order originates from and is nurtured. So that's sort of one set of anxieties about social reproduction. The other set is basically that the ability of the broad middle class to access a higher education has been substantially diminished over a long string of decades as the promise of public higher education at on an affordable basis has been steadily reduced. And that comes about what I've referred to elsewhere as this sort of three-way alliance between college administrations, state legislatures, and the federal government in the following way. The state legislatures want to defund college campuses. They don't think that higher education should be broadly available as a public good in the states that they administer. They would rather have that those budget items basically go to the rich in the form of tax cuts. So consequently, they look to defund these institutions. In response, the administrators basically want to raise tuition. That's how they preserve their budgetary status, and they promise the state legislatures basically there'll be no reduction in the actual quality of the instruction in the state university. You can still go to all the football games at the big fancy stadium, and also cut funding. And the way we'll make up for it is by raising tuition. And then the sort of federal government's piece here is basically backstopping that higher tuition, lower public funding equilibrium in higher education, because they originate student loans for students to be able to pay that higher tuition. So obviously the ability of universities to charge high tuition would be substantially less if there weren't open-handed federal loans available. And the federal government's policy is basically they want as many people enrolling in as much higher education as possible, and consequently have been steadily increasing loan limits. I mean, the most egregious version of that is in the 2006 when the federal government uncapped graduate student tuition altogether. So it was like, you know, you can take out any amount of debt to pay tuition at a bona fide graduate program at a university that qualifies for federal aid. And of course, that invited the universities just proliferate all sorts of graduate programs that are eligible for that uncapped tuition, and they're all cash cows. You know, kind of between those three things, you've got this run up in student debt, run up in tuition, reduction in the accessibility of the campus to a broad swath of students. And then nowadays, you know, as the kind of idea that everyone should go to college is coming under more and more pressure, you know, due to the price and the inability of people to repay their student loans and so on, you know, we're very much in this sort of race or race to the bottom and elite status. I mean, maybe they would consider that a race to the top. So the idea is basically get the students who can pay full tuition to come to our university, give them the financial aid that's necessary to make them enroll here versus elsewhere. These are the students who have the opportunity to go kind of wherever they want. And in order to obtain that high prestige, you know, we've got to, you know, basically worsen the experience, if not close it off to everybody else. So shifting from in-state to out-of-state students, from undergraduates, in-state undergraduates to master's students, and especially international master's students. I mean, the whole international thing is a real racket, in my opinion. I mean, I love international students that I actually teach and know they're excellent, but you know, it seems like basically we are lying to the world's middle class to upper middle class to get them to pay our full tuition to come here on the false promise that they'll get a worker visa at the end of their student visa, which most people don't. Okay, so that's my big rant about higher education. The point is the anxiety about social reproduction there is, you know, this thing that used to be an engine of social mobility and access to higher learning for a broad swath of the population is diminishing, along with a whole, you know, broad swath of the public estate, as I refer to it in the piece.
You know, just as a data point too, like the law school that I went to, they their admissions now, their primary like 1L class, they admit many fewer people than they used to. And what they do is they take in, because it's like a top whatever 20-ish law school or something like that. So it's like fairly high prestige, but not like, you know, it's not like Harvard or whatever. But what they'll do is they'll take in a smaller but more selective admissions class so that they can report good numbers to U.S. News and World Reports. And then they take in a bunch of transfers and international students for a second year, knowing that those people are willing to pay full freight for 2 years to get their degree from a higher institute, you know, like a higher ranked institution than the one that they were initially admitted to. And it, you know, it does have the benefit too of they've demonstrated that they're very good law students in the first year of law school, which is, you know, predictive of a lot of things. So it's a very savvy strategy, but I mean, it's exactly along the lines of what you're talking about. And I should say also, my law school went to the so-called Michigan model, which is basically they renounced state funding and became like a quasi-private institution. And, you know, even in the time that I was there, in-state tuition went up tens of thousands of dollars between my first and my last year in law school, which required me to take out additional loans because I initially went there because I thought I was going to basically get no loans because I got in-state tuition and I got a nice scholarship. But nope, turns out that's not how it works anymore. So,
yeah, I mean, especially the increased tuition after you enroll thing is extremely pernicious and actually pervasive in higher education. I mean, we did a report on a senior fellow in higher education finance at the Jane Family Institute. We did a report a couple of years ago about the so-called, basically the system where they charge lower tuition, give more generous financial aid in your first year when you have the option to choose among other institutions, and then basically ramp up tuition in subsequent years when you've already said, oh yes, I'm going here, and at that point transferring is more costly.
Right.
And also the federal loan system for undergraduates, I think for graduates, it's uncapped throughout, as I just referred to. For undergraduate, the loan limits go up as you progress through college because the government doesn't want people to drop out due to finances. And that just, I mean, it's been shown, you know, very clearly that the institutions just basically increase tuition in step with the increased loan limits as you go from sophomore to junior to senior to senior year. And in fact, I was, my department chair was said to me in or said to all of us in a faculty meeting a couple of weeks ago, like, oh, you know, the university president just said that that's what they do in a meeting of all the department chairs. And I was, you know, like, of course we do that. That's the savviest thing to do. And I was like, you know, Marshall, you told me that's what they're doing. Anyway, the report that I was referring to shows, you know, that's not just, you know, kind of like fly by night operations. I mean, the University of Utah is a state flagship. The report talks about that pattern at, you know, the absolute most elite private institutions in the whole country. You know, so it's not, I mean, one thing that I have long felt since I kind of got into the higher education policy game about a decade ago is the sort of people who, at least, I mean, I guess I've always been broadly on the left of the political spectrum. Those people tend to denigrate in the higher education context. They tend to denigrate for-profit institutions, which are obviously very exploitative during the financial crisis and immediately afterward, and be like, oh, by contrast, the nonprofits and the traditional institutions are so great. Education is so wonderful. You know, students should get as much higher education as they can because it's you know, the route to stable employment in the labor market, and like that's the good way of showing that you're one of us, namely the highly educated meritocratic elite. And you know, they totally overlook that all of these business models that the higher ed, that the for-profit higher education institutions pioneered have been completely brought in-house at every other institution. So there's no real meaningful, like, moral distinction between those legal definitions now.
Right. I mean, it's just the sort of the public commons have been pretty much fully privatized and taken advantage of. And I think you and I were talking about this before, but it's sort of like how, you know, when you create a huge homeless problem, suddenly the parks and the libraries are filled with homeless people, and say what you want about it, it's not pleasant to be around a lot of times. And then people rightly go like, well, I don't really want to go to the park and the library now. And I think that, you know, you see a similar kind of thing happening with colleges, where it's like, these, you know, these should be public goods that everyone can all agree that, like, oh yeah, this is a good thing that we should, you know, that's just sort of like a good thing that we provide for our society. But, you know, now I think if you look critically at these things from whatever political perspective, there's a lot of things to dislike about it. So and that just kind of comes with the territory of, you know, this sort of step of creating these problems and then kind of pushing them onto this public good and you know, denigrating it basically.
Yeah. I mean, that you could see that definitely within whole public higher education systems of,
yeah.
I mean, it's just, again, you know, this is the what I know best, where I teach at the University of Utah, you know, administration clearly wants to kind of make it an attractive destination for out-of-state students, specifically students from California who, you know, can't get into UC Berkeley and consider UC Merced to be beneath them socially. Like, oh, you know, you can go to Salt Lake City where the snowboarding and skiing is really great, and pay, you know, whatever the full out-of-state tuition is here. And they just opened a whole other campus on the other side of Salt Lake Valley. So like 30 miles away from the main campus, which is, you know, a little bit cheaper, I assume, for the local in-state students than the population that the university is actually supposed to serve. So it's like, we'll give you, I mean, yeah, I don't know, Andrew, if you've ever been to Salt Lake City, not while I've been here, or at least you haven't told me if you've been in town, but
no.
The university towers over the rest of the city up on a hill. It's very nice. I'm surrounded by mountains. You know, Utah is very scenic. And, you know, the feeling of it is, you know, they're building all these fancy new dormitories on campus. It's like, oh, we have this nice city on the hill, you know, where, you know, the kind of right kind of student from California can come and have a nice dorm room and skateboard to class and whatever and see the beautiful
right.
mountains. And then like in a parking lot 30 miles away is the other campus that's for actual people in Utah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, the only time I've ever been to Utah, I drove through from Denver to Las Vegas, which is a very scenic route, but not a lot of population going on there.
Yes. No, that's, I was down there a couple of weeks ago, but anyway, we don't have to go into Utah scenery. Come visit me sometime. I
should. Yeah.
I extend that invitation to Andrew and to all of our legions of listeners.
right. It probably just to close personal friends, basically. So you're pretty safe doing it, I think. Well, yeah, I think we were going to, you know, chat a little bit about, too, because I had some thoughts that you and I have talked about a little bit. You know, I was going to say them off the cuff, like I was going to make a brilliant point just from hearing your summary. But I feel that we should be honest to our listeners and say we've talked about this beforehand. But this to me fits in with sort of the position of the, I guess, a certain part of the American upper middle class. This is very fraught terminology, I guess, but, you know, the kinds of people who make their money doing essentially high paid service jobs for people who have more money than them. Talking about lawyers, programmers, insurance people, finance people. You know, there's some category bleed here because obviously some people get into those positions and they become a member of the ultra wealthy class, whether through ownership or just through basically controlling the money spigot in large organizations, which is sort of the ownership class of our time, I guess. I think, I don't remember exactly when this piece came out, but there was some piece in, you know, The Atlantic or one of those similar type magazines that was like, actually, the problem isn't the 1%. The problem is the top 10%. And, you know, it talked about all these dynamics of sort of the upper middle class, where the upper middle class is sort of against the other 90%. And I kind of think that that's mostly bullshit. I think that, you know, really, when it comes down to the major divides in society, the major divide is between the ownership, the ultra wealthy class, and basically everybody else. Everybody else faces, you know, a struggle to reproduce their station. Whereas if you were in the top 1%, your station is reproducible to your children no matter what you do, unless you lose all your money. But I mean, you know,
vanishingly few people do that. No, I think right. That's absolutely right. I mean, the point I would make about the sort of unity of interest among the bottom 99% is exactly what you said. The top 10% minus the top 1% work for the top 1%. You know, right. That is the status of alienation in labor. Like, you have to work for someone else and do what they say, even if you get paid well and live in a nice house versus get paid poorly and don't have a place to live. You know, you're still in that situation of alienation.
Right. And I think, you know, some people, Marshall and I have gone into the intellectual trenches on this one, but some people will say basically, well, actually, that's not so much of a distinction because actually the top 1%, most of them actually do work just as much as, you know, the top 10% or even, you know, basically up and down the spectrum. I mean, you know, whatever, whoever it is, Steve Jobs or, you know, any of these sort of lionized individuals who, or, you know, Warren Buffett or whatever, you know, people who, you know, they just have a whole self-mythology that involves working 80 hour weeks, even though they have more money than God. And, you know, to that, I guess our response is basically like, well, yeah, but their labor, the quantity of their labor is not what's generating the value. What's generating the value is either their ownership of something or their means to control the distribution of resources within an organization that has money. And I would basically say, and I think Marshall would agree with this, that if you own something or you are basically like the CEO and control the money flows and therefore can pay yourself $250 million to be a CEO, and then, you know, anything that comes after to explain why that was actually, you know, your labor hour is worth $1 million or something is a just so story that basically elides the fact that the way you're making money is by paying yourself money from controlling the mechanism of money flow within the organization. You stand closest to the money spigot, so you drink first, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I totally agree with that. I mean, I teach this literature, you know, Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century and the sort of papers that preceded and postdated that about, you know, kind of, first of all, how rich are the top 1%, and second of all, who are they, versus a paper called Capitalists in the 21st Century, which is kind of the economics rendition of the book The Meritocracy Trap by Daniel Markovitz, and Andrew's referring to our past review of that book and back and forth with Markovitz, because, you know, he makes a big deal of this distinction between exactly how he makes a big deal of it is we had our differences with, but he doesn't make the distinction that Andrew just made is our general take on
right
this. The Capitalists in the 21st Century paper is exactly along the lines of you're saying is that the top 1% of labor income earners are workers. That's their thesis. And the way that you can tell that they're workers is that, one, they work for a living, unlike capitalists who are like retired or rentiers that never work. And two, that like the organizations that they control and run, you know, kind of like depend on their presence for those organizations, like say a law firm or something. You know, the revenue of the law firm depends on the business that is brought in by the top partners,
right,
who get paid the biggest payout. So that's why they're saying those people are workers. Our view, the one that Andrew just put forward, is like, you know, those people are in control. So whether you interpret their income as like due to their labor, due to their capital, that's kind of not helpful at that level of the social hierarchy. What is, you know, what's relevant is that they are in control, that they dominate their surroundings and, you know, sometimes well beyond their surroundings. And that is what puts them in a, you know, position of domination towards the bottom 99%, you know, whether it's their own lawyer, their own doctor, or, you know, the person who cleans the office. You know, it's kind of the same basic dynamic. Now, having said all of that, I think what we're getting to is higher ed is where we do see this distinction really matter.
Correct.
And you can kind of discern some of those dynamics a little bit more fully. So why don't you discuss that?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I just read Capital in the 19th century, also known as Capital. So
I didn't realize that you were a latter day convert to Marxism.
Oh, well, I mean, I would say I'm a Marxian,
not a Marxist.
I don't think I'm doctrinaire in really anything, but regardless of, whether it's economics or politics or whatever, but I did find it. I mean, it's just an extraordinary book. Anyways, I do want to get to something that a fundamental insight of Marx's interpretation of class reproduction. But let's introduce this next part first. I'll cut this part. The thing that I wanted to sort of elucidate in talking about sort of this upper middle class, top 10% stratum of society, is that there is an advantage, and I wouldn't say this is a causal mechanism necessarily, although maybe it's a driving mechanism once the forces are already in motion, but there is an advantage to college being expensive for this group of people. And that advantage is that they can pay the money. And so what you see is increasingly, I think you see a group of people who are able to just pay the money, and maybe they get a scholarship, a merit scholarship or not. I mean, obviously they have the resources to get good SAT scores, and like the average SAT score in Westchester County is like 1450 or something insane like that, right? So I mean, it's like clearly at some level, like, whether it's just having money or just having the background that, where you have certain kinds of conversations and learn certain kinds of words and certain kinds of like logical reasoning as a child, whatever the case is, people who are the genetics to some degree too, although I think we'll come on to sort of why the sort of return of eugenics in our time is an incredibly annoying phenomenon, if not pernicious. Increasingly, you see this bifurcation of like the people who go to these colleges basically being either, these sort of top 10 upper middle class people, and then people who get merit-based scholarships from just sort of scattershot throughout the spectrum, or need-based scholarships, closer toward the bottom end of the income spectrum. The people who are sort of left out of this are, I would say, like the sort of just regular middle-class people, especially those who are like kind of from the middle of the country, whose parents don't have the kind of like professional, what would you call it? Like professional symbol manipulation type jobs, like somebody
higher
who's wealthy.
Reasoning is what those people call themselves.
Right. The dynamic that I wanted to flag is basically like, for people who are in this top 10% by virtue of their parents having these kinds of, logical reasoning type jobs, it's very good for them actually that college is expensive, because they can pay it. And people up and down, basically the people they're competing with for their kids to maintain the same kind of jobs that they want, or that they currently have, to reproduce their class status, basically, in sort of a, jargony kind of way of putting it, are just going to be priced out of it. And so they're going to be going to, maybe directional state schools instead of the flagship state school. And they certainly probably aren't going to be going to Harvard, Stanford, Chicago, Princeton, Dartmouth, Yale, blah, blah, blah.
I think that's a very astute point. And I certainly agree with that. I mean, you said earlier, the absolute ultra wealthy, basically they can reproduce their class status in their children, basically, regardless of what they do, just by virtue of the amount of wealth that they can give them.
Right.
I think the top 10% minus the top 1% class, at least doesn't consider themselves to be in that position. Now, I mean, the question of how true that apprehension is or false and cultivated, I think it does absolutely get to the dynamic behind the institutions basically competitively cranking up the tuition, because mm-hmm. You're in the dynamic of like the higher the tuition, the harder it is to get in, which means it's more worth it. So it's like a country club's admissions fee or something like that. This
right.
is why in the piece I referred to the country club model of college admissions, because like, yeah, you're winnowing the crowd, but you're also making the people who are left more willing to pay the higher tuition that you're charging.
Right.
And then also there's the business of merit-based financial aid, as we talked about earlier, which is those, the kind of the children of the top 10% are hot properties when it comes to college administration, because that's what makes your institution look elite, which means those people are getting the financial aid offers. I mean, there was a very telling episode a couple of months ago at the University of Arizona Where, you know, they're in a budget crisis and the president sent, you know, gave a message. I don't know if it was an address to the faculty senate or something, you know, basically justifying why, you know, everyone's raises would have to be canceled and there's going to be a salary freeze and a hiring freeze or whatever. And he's like, well, the problem is all of our students are paying less than it actually costs to educate them because we all gave the ones that we wanted such generous financial aid offers that like we have exactly the student body that we want. It's just an insolvent institution that came out of it. So it's like, okay, you know, that I mean, nothing, you know, they got the balance wrong. The idea is that like you give the financial aid that you need to bring in those students so that others are willing to pay more and you operate obviously in the black, you know, and give the professor or they give the president of the university a fat raise for doing all that. You know, like somebody, the guy whose job was to manage the spreadsheet really screwed up in that case.
Right.
You know, they didn't get the balance quite right. You know, but you like, you can see the sort of reasoning at work. So I mean, I just think you're absolutely right in kind of diagnosing where the reactionary centrist upper middle class parent apprehensive over the fate of higher education, like what, you know, it's like, okay, well, the deal was I pay $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 a year, and my kid goes to school with only people who are exactly like them, from whose other parents they're going to get their first job, and so on. You know, that deal is somehow sacrificed if, for example, racial justice protesters get a more racially egalitarian admissions policy put in place. It's like, okay, well, you know, you're just, you know, kind of yanking away the anchor to social status that I was counting on to derive from the higher education system.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, there's another class of people too. It's more like liberal people who would be like, well, you know, it's actually a feature of college admissions that they sort of allow a few of the racial minorities into the college so that, you know, you can get it like improves the experience in some way or whatever. So, you know, that's it. But either way, it's, you know, the way that it's sort of, like you said, it's like a country club. And, you know, much like a country club is basically like a social institution that allows people who are too wealthy to have friends to be friends with their dentist.
Ouch.
I mean, that's true, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
you know, what a country club is it's a place where the people who are like the true national or international wealthy people in a community, to the extent there are those people can't have more than a couple like peer friends or whatever. And so what a country club does is it lets you have a membership into a place where you're all sort of on an equal footing with people who, you know, for all intents and purposes, live very similar. Like there might be a little bit more space between your furniture than theirs, but like that's basically the difference in terms of like day-to-day life for people like that, especially because like we were talking about, most very rich people work now. And I think, you know, the country club model of university basically is like, well, whenever you see, you know, whatever, some like Elon Musk's kid goes to college and then,
well, yeah,
you know,
I don't think Elon Musk talks to his children. So,
oh, know. That's true. Whatever you, well, you know, some rich kids, or, you know, some celebrity or whatever goes to college. And it's like,
well,
you know,
mean,
it's,
I mean, the example I linked to in the piece is Bill Ackman, you know, this guy who went to war against Harvard, his daughter, you know, graduated with a degree in like comparative literature and Marxism or something like that.
Right.
And it's obvious that all of his, anger towards the institution is premised on the idea that they like, you know, took his daughter and perverted her away from her destined path of succeeding him as, you know, head of a hedge fund or whatever, marrying the head of a hedge fund. I don't know.
Whatever. Give it 10 years.
You think
I don't think he's going to have too much to worry about, but.
Well, he obviously doesn't agree with you. He's very upset about this.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the other point that you made in all, so you're saying the sort of like affirmative point of who's willing to pay this, you know, is like the ticket to upper middle class stability and the reproduction of that stability across generations, you know,
right.
the kind of inverse of that is who's not there. The space on campus that is reserved for those people means that a certain other set of people get rolled out. And I think that really, you know, kind of underlies the culture war of this, you know, that, yeah.
Totally. Well, and I think, you know, the way you can put this, you can put this in a way that sounds very conservative, which would basically be to say that, like, you know, the people who aren't there are like the salt of the earth, you know, son of a contractor from Abilene, Kansas, conservative values, whatever, doesn't like all the hippy dippy bullshit that goes on campus. But I think, you know, a lot of that differentiation, which really has taken place in the last 20 years or so, is the result of, I would say, sort of a downstream sort of like coping process, basically. it's not necessarily like a causal mechanism of like why those people don't go to college. I would say those people don't go to college because, well, first of all, you know, most of the time what you do in life is determined by what your parents did. You know, like I think people are like 30 times more likely to be the same profession as their parent than they are any other profession or something like that. So, and that
did,
falls
did
for me.
Jake and Binder's tweets about this, pushing back against the, well, we may come back to this later, but the Theo Brady, or is that, isn't, no, Theo Baker.
Theo, right.
Yeah. Yeah. His, piece about Stanford, you know, when it's like, okay, well, he placed this campus culture war thing in the Atlantic, and a lot of people are attacking him as a Nepo baby. And right. Ann Binder was like, how dare you attack him as a Nepo baby? You know, most people in history have been Nepo babies in the sense that they went into the same profession as their parents. So the, you know, the son apprentice to their dad cobbler who becomes a cobbler, and you apprentice to your dad lawyer who became a lawyer, is the same as Theo Baker getting his piece about campus politics at Stanford into the Atlantic by virtue of his
right
prize winning parents.
Totally. I mean, it's the exact same thing. So I see the point she's making. It's perfectly clear.
Yeah.
You know, people who are like maybe lower to middle class, who aren't really the local gentry, but are, you know, whose parents might be like a contractor who's maybe not making huge bank, maybe a contractor who is in the middle class, who's not scraping by, who can afford, you know, to live in a suburb and has like a reasonably nice house and, you know, a family and whatever. Those are people whose kids, I think, are not at these flagship institutions, state institutions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The administration of those institutions thinks that this institution, this place that I'm the president of, is not for that kid. That kid should go to another 4-year institution or a community college in the state.
Right.
But that we're, you know, as I described the University of Utah earlier, like we're building this country club enclave on a hill for not for them. They are the ones to go to the campus that's 30 miles away across the valley.
And yeah, the point that we were discussing before is that, you know, I think a lot of the sort of ideological separation between, you know, and I think a very salient category is, you know, going to college versus not going to college. But I do think also possibly a salient category is like going to a flagship state university or, you know, or better, like an Ivy or Ivy equivalent or private university, and going to like a directional state school or a 2-year school or, you know, some combination of those things. And I think, like you said, there's this idea that those institutions aren't for, you know, these sort of lower middle class to middle class people whose parents don't have a professional style job. Obviously, they're professionals in something, but I mean, I just mean like not sitting at a desk and answering emails and writing stuff. I think a lot of the first of all, we should clarify the reason that those institutions aren't for those people is because they can't pay. It's not because they're evil Trump chuds, MAGA, you know, deplorables or whatever, but there is a huge relationship between those things because it's a very convenient kind of rationale for why these places aren't for these people. And I think a rationale that probably the people believe in as the actual rationale, even though it's downstream of the actual cause.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I worry especially about my fellow professors who kind of want to fight the culture war, like we're the only righteous people in this red state, you know, defending the one righteous institution in this red state. And that righteousness is derived exactly from the exclusion of, you know, the people who we think are, you know, we don't imagine as the type of students that we would teach every day in the classroom.
Well, I mean, it's so interesting that it goes so against like the mid-century model of the university where, you know, what's the name of the guy who Mike Davis, Davis was like a trucker who went to college, you know, like,
yeah. I feel like the more I do this job and work in this business of higher education, like the more oriented I become towards like the lost reality of the quote unquote non-traditional student. So, you know, that's like basically definitely not envisioned as the clientele of the state flagship institution because they're going to have a job. They're not going to live in the dorms on campus. They're not going to, you know, think like, you know, if what the institution is trying to do is make itself look as much like an Ivy as possible or look as much like an elite private institution as possible, where it's a bunch of people who go there full time directly after graduate school and like graduate in 4 years by, you know, kind of you know, going through college, like having the college experience or whatever with their class, you know, obviously somebody who's been a trucker, who has a family or something, or obligations, like, you know, they're going to go to college at best because like they're interested in it, or, you know, maybe it has some utility to them professionally, you know, but they're not going to like buy into the campus experience. They're not going to pay the premium that goes into buying into the campus experience. So it's like, okay, well, this campus, the state flagship, is not for those people. Those people can go to community college. That's the implication. And then what you're saying as a policy matter is the state flagship institution in state X is not available to the citizens of state X unless you check some very specific box, you know, set of boxes. And, you know, that's basically a tacit agreement between the institution itself and the legislature and the federal government, as I said earlier. And, you know, the legislature tells the institution, you know, go recruit students elsewhere. You know, providing higher education to the people of Utah is not what the University of Utah exists to do. It's like, okay, well, you're setting yourself up for institutional demise in that case.
Yeah, well, and, it, you know, it's sort of like what we were talking about earlier with, like, you know, if you trade on the value of a public good and you make it less desirable, or you make it so that it's not, you know, a welcoming environment or whatever the case is, you know, then it degrades it.
Yeah. And I mean, you have the collapse of a pooling equilibrium, to use the economics jargon of this, which is, you know, the public good that everyone goes to, you know, if everyone thinks there's a place for me there, then we're happy to have that exist and pay taxes for it. And, you know, think like this is the, you know, to the greater glory of the state, you know, versus if this isn't for me, well, screw them. I don't want that to exist. You know, I don't want to be taxed for that. There's nothing for me in here. You know, I don't want to go to the park anymore, or, you know, I don't want to ride the bus anymore.
Yeah.
You know, because it's been totally taken over by people who are not like me and who I don't want to be around.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, it's just, it really is a shame, because, you know, it sort of, you get it from both ends, because I don't think that like the liberal version of these institutions is a good vision of them either, you know. It's very exclusionary, and it's really based on like especially in this sort of top 10% stratum that we're talking about, it's purely a, you know, self-interested reason. And, you know, you might have all these justifications about how, well, you know, I don't know, like a Trump voter is so far beyond the pale that you don't want your precious little Jaden going to school with them or whatever, but like, you know, or Braylon or Caden or whatever, you know, but,
you just named nine of the different people that are currently enrolled in my class.
Exactly. Well, you're in Utah, so that makes sense. It's probably I have a theory that like the next innovation in white names is going to be three of the same consonant in a row.
I think I've got a few of those already. I don't know,
like Jaden, but with like three N's at the end or something, or like, because like you got a lot of twos, but I don't know if we've really innovated into the three space yet, you know what I mean? But I do believe the Mormons will be the first to do it, though, because they're out ahead of the curve. They're on their own little planet, so to speak.
Not yet.
Yeah, right. So the one thing I wanted to get back to is this sort of like reproduction of status through college, through the mechanism of college, because obviously if you're rich, you know, the way you reproduce your status is you just hand your money to the next generation. You have enough of it that your child is, even if, you know, you might have multiple of them, but you have enough of it that you're able to provide to them your standard of living and a start in whatever they want to do, whether that's
R is greater than G. Remember that? Meaning, meaning basically there's nothing you can do that will diminish the amount of wealth that you have. And, you know, even if you've got two children, so you have to divide your wealth in half, like by the time you're old enough that you're doing that, you'll have twice as much wealth as you currently do.
Right.
So you'll be able to give them exactly what you started with.
Yeah, basically, yeah. So, you know, and obviously, you know, people, I think there's a human urge to do stuff. It's, you know, people don't, for the most part, especially, you know, our culture, I think this is culture bound to some degree too, because obviously, you know, there was a lot of idle rich people in, you know, 19th century America, for instance, but less so today. And, you know, people want to do stuff. So it's not to say that like, whatever. And also you have people like Warren Buffett who say, I'm giving my kid $100,000 and they're going to have to earn every red cent, you know, whatever. It's there's all sorts of ideology layered on top of this. But like, if you're wealthy enough, you can just guarantee your kid having the same standard of living that you do and the same general like set of opportunities in life that you do. And this goes regardless of really their aptitude or their talent or, you know, anything.
Also, you can make, I mean, with enough money, you can just basically make any child smart.
True. But then, you know, when you start getting below that, you have a less of a, you don't have the automatic ability to confer that just purely by handing the money from you to the next generation. Like, I would say that's probably the case for, you know, well, it's the case for most people who are outside of the top 1% of our society or whatever. Maybe there's some people who are technically in the top 2% or something who can do this. But I mean, roughly speaking. And like, I used to work at a state agency that was like a court. And one of the things that they did was oversee the approval of individual education plans, IEPs, which are like the thing that happens if little Braylon can't read very well then and needs special education, then there's like a plan that comes in. It's all under federal law. And, you know, you saw two different versions of how these proceedings would go. And the first one was if it was someone who was maybe didn't have a ton of money, you know, they'd be advocating for their kid and they'd have a lawyer and most of the time and et cetera. But it was when you saw people who were in this top 10% or close enough that you really saw how much this means. Because if little Braylon can't read and the way that you're planning to pass on your class status to little Braylon is to have her go to college to do the same kind of job that you do. And she can't get into a flagship state school at best. That's really tough. So there's a tremendous amount of anxiety and negative emotions over these proceedings, because what was at stake was essentially like, is my kid, who is like 5 years old, by the way, or whatever, you know, is my 5 year old going to be able to one day have the privilege of getting paid $200,000 to open emails? And, you know, like, there's a whole series of steps that need to be undertaken and check boxes that need to be checked and everything. So yeah, I don't know if you have any particular thoughts on that process, but it's a very interesting thing to me that I'd like to talk about a little bit. So
yeah, no, please continue if you'd like to. I mean, I think that's a apt analogy to what goes on in the college campus, frankly.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so I've recently been reading Capital, and one of the things that Marx talks about that I think maybe gets a bit of a misread, to the extent it's read, is his discussion of social reproduction, essentially, which he discusses as basically what is the market price of labor. And so if you read Marx, you encounter this kind of confusing passage. I would say not necessarily confusing, but maybe not intuitive passage that basically says the cost of labor is the market price of labor is what it takes to reproduce labor. He basically says all commodities are sold for their cost, basically. The cost that it takes to make them. And so what is the cost of a worker? The cost to make a worker. Well, what goes into making a worker? And then he goes into a very 19th century look at this, which is like, you need to have a hovel and you need to have some bread in that hovel. And then you need to have, you know, various attendant necessities in that hovel. And then you need to have some urchins in the hovel so that they can one day occupy it and do your job. So, you know, all told, and then, you know, there's certain other things in there like training and, you know, whatever, but like, essentially, the way he conceptualizes it is very sort of like Iron Law of Wages era, you know, back when there were people who really wanted some more porridge at the workhouse or whatever, you know. And I think that really puts people off of believing that this is how the cost of workers' labor is set. But I want to suggest that, yes, indeed, this is exactly how it works. And I will offer the following example for our, you know, very real, totally, you know, productive 21st century economy. Let's say that there is a person who has a successful YouTube channel and they're making, let's just say $100,000 a month from uploading YouTube videos. And so they're just rolling in money. Now, they put out a call for a video editor, and the video editor, when they're accepting that job, is not going to go, what is the fair amount of $1.2 million that I should make? The video editor is going to say, how much money do I expect in my station based on my education and training? What is going to allow me to live the lifestyle that I'm accustomed to and to allow me to do the things in my life that I want to do, which often includes having a family and, you know, raising the next generation of workers? And, you know, I'm not going to be paid $35,000 for this. I'll tell you that much. I'm going to be paid $80,000 for that, because that's what I'm expecting commensurate to being able to reproduce my life. And I would say that in that sense, that is exactly, you know, how Marx applies to our modern world. It doesn't involve how much bread you need in your hovel anymore, because like we're talking about, you know, a sort of a class strata that didn't really exist in Marx's time, but that operate on the same principles. But it's just that there's this more abstract notion. It's not maybe like an iron law of wages situation. It's more of an abstract notion of like, you know, what it will take for you to be hired for a job that, you know, that will allow you to, in the Marxist terminology, to reproduce yourself, reproduce your class stage, reproduce your class among your kids, whatever the case is. And you will accept things that are within that range, and you won't accept things that are not within that range. And like I said, even if this guy's YouTube, even if you know this guy's making, rolling in the, you know, millions of dollars of YouTube revenue or whatever, you're not going to be like, yeah, I want half to be your video editor. Like, that's just not the kind of demand that a worker can make in the labor market, because they'll just say, well, guess what? I'm going to hire someone else for $80,000 because that's what a video editor expects to reproduce their class station or whatever. So I think, you know, an interesting thing about this, though, is that I think that a lot of these like middle stratum jobs, upper middle stratum jobs, are sort of like they allow a certain degree of autonomy. Like, one of the reasons that they're so high prestige, I would say, is because they allow a tremendous amount of autonomy in the worker. You're not managed like you're on a factory floor if you're a lawyer or an accountant or
right.
A professor.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point because, you know, general. I mean, I don't fully agree with that, to be totally honest. Like, okay, this idea that the labor market is, you know, a place where like workers are subordinate to bosses. I just think that's like an inherent characteristic, whether you're talking about Amazon delivery driver or a lawyer, you know, but like the actual work process is extremely different, obviously. And the lawyer,
that's what I mean. Yeah.
So social status is, you know, I think you're right to locate it in the idea of like, I don't have to, you know, pay attention to whatever the machine that's telling me to, you know, run faster and don't pee when I want to, you know, I don't have to be degraded to that degree. So like, even though I don't fundamentally have control over the work process as a lawyer, nor do I as an Amazon delivery driver, like the feeling of the job is quite different, basically. And this, I mean, I do a lot of stuff in like the gig economy, broadly speaking. And like, what I think attracts a lot of workers to that is exactly that, you know, like they could all, you know, everyone in the gig economy could work at Walmart if they wanted to, and, you know, be under the thumb of a store manager 24/7. And even, you know, if you're driving for rideshare or something like that, you are under the control of the platform algorithm to an enormous extent, but it doesn't feel that way. Like, you do fundamentally feel more autonomous, that you don't have the asshole boss screwing with your life all the time. You know, so totally. I think, you know, you're absolutely right to say that people derive a lot of, you know, self-worth and image from their ability to escape that kind of, you know, direct control and subordination that the labor process implies. To get back to the higher education thing, so this idea that, you know, like what I'll be paid is the cost to reproduce my class status. I mean, this kind of brings us back to the beginning of the conversation, because the implication of higher education costing more and being more exclusionary is it costs more to reproduce my class status, and or it's not possible to because I no longer have access to the state university or something like that.
Right.
You know, and so that's, you know, kind of exactly accomplishing the collapse of the public good and the separation of all of society into our own spheres, you know, and desire to have nothing to do with one another and viewing everybody else as the enemy or coming from an outgroup, you know, that's totally alien,
right?
Because we don't have this sort of like public gathering space that's available to everyone and is you know, a uniting force in society.
Well, I mean, fundamentally, like one of the things that bosses often, you know, like to do is to in the Fordist economy, for instance, like one of the things that you would want to do as a boss is to basically make the cost of reproduction, of class reproduction, as low as possible so that you can pay as low as possible. Because like, essentially, like, look, you know, if it goes from costing $100 a week to feed your family to $50 a week to feed your family, well, then you need to, then the amount of money that people are willing to accept to do the job that you're going to offer them is $50 less, generally speaking. So, you know, in that respect, I think there's somewhat of a unique character in upper middle class jobs, in that I think a lot of times, like, the people who are controlling the upper middle class jobs are often like in the upper middle class too. And I think that, like, you know, there's an interesting sort of like class solidarity that can happen between boss and worker, within this stratum where it's sort of like, it's like how, you know, everyone in America thinks that they're like a future millionaire or whatever. I think that like there's a way in which like people who are like your boss, when you have like a high status job, are like, they view you as a future boss in some ways. And so like, there's like a degree of, you know, these jobs are often like kind of for us, by us, you know, it's like, okay, well, you have to go through the hard knocks that I went through, and I'm sure going to run you through the gamut and make your life hell. But yeah, like,
I mean, I certainly saw that in the nonprofit world of like, right. You know, the people who succeed are the ones who tell their bosses that like, oh, I think I idolize you and want to become you, mm-hmm. you know, and like the organization exists basically for the purpose of glorifying and reassuring and like morally assuaging its current staff and donors, and not to like serve any public purpose or you know, anything that goes beyond its walls.
Right. So, but I guess, you know, one thing that I find kind of interesting about that is it suggests to me, well, and oftentimes, like, you know, because of like literal class solidarity, like, you know, there's some bleeding lines between like the amount of money that they're willing to pay you, and also the fact that they're like kind of do, like, a lot of times they're doing you like a literal favor. Like we were talking about with the Nepo baby, in the Atlantic or whatever. It's like, sometimes you find that like you get these jobs and it's like they're kind of paying me more than they should be, you know, like maybe not. I don't know if I've ever experienced this personally, but I mean, this definitely happens where it's like, you know, I'm in this job as a favor. And like there's a lot of like, it's an interesting class dynamic, I think, because like, you know, I totally agree with you that it's not like you don't have a boss. It's not like you don't have someone riding you, but like the way that the boss employee relationship works is totally different because there's a degree of solidarity there. Or a degree of like, even like literally doing a favor there sometimes, a lot of times.
Yeah. I mean, I just returned to my own experience in the nonprofit world where the solidarity between boss and worker is ideological, where it's like, we right. are among the select few good and correct people in society who are all working at this good and correct and virtuous job and not doing all, you know, anything from, you know, private equity all the way down to like digging ditches or something
right.
that, you know, isn't good, that doesn't have this like social validation attached to it.
Well, that's kind of a long way of setting up the idea that, like, I don't necessarily know if there's a check in the economy for the way that that college prices are spiraling upward, because I think that, like,
there is no check. I mean, you would have to have, so definitely reform to the student loan system and the dynamic that you referred to earlier of, in some sense, you know, higher end people willing to pay this price exactly because it is exclusionary.
Right.
You know, that's... You know, usually if you think of an economic market, like, okay, you know, there's like the monopolist price is the highest possible price that any, you know, the most powerful seller is willing to sell. They're not going to push it above that because then they're shooting themselves in the foot. You know, it doesn't seem like we're anywhere near that. And I don't know when that would arise in
right.
the context of college. And like, no, you know, there is not a single college administrator in the country who's like, you know, what we should be doing is holding the line on tuition and opening our doors to non-traditional students, you know, to come here. It's like everyone is scrambling to be the right. most prestigious institution in the country. You know, if you look at these public institutions that are currently being wrecked, like West Virginia University, UNC Greensboro, you know, what they are is they've got an administrator that has like, you know, it is very similar to the private equity business model, because there's administrators who, like, you know, boards of trustees send from institution to institution to wreck the place, you know, for the better profit or whatever interest the board is serving. You know, and like, there's no, you know, what would resist that in society is like solidarity among university workers, solidarity among the student population with the university workers. Like, it would just take a social movement to put a stop to that business model, and no such social movement appears on the horizon. I mean, there have been some great successes in student organizing and grad student labor and so on at universities, but it does, like, the mass constituency for, let's actually have a higher education system that serves the public, basically doesn't exist.
Right. Well, and I was, you know, I just wanted to kind of walk through the idea of like the sort of the cross-class intra-class connections of the upper middle class, just to sort of show that, like, you know, one place you might expect to see a check is if employers are like, well, we have to pay too much goddamn money so that parents can send their kids to college to have this job in the future.
Yeah.
But the problem is that the people who control, who get those jobs, are those people.
Yeah,
who have those kids, who have that same interest. It's sort of like another sort of countervailing confounding situation is like in healthcare, where
you would think that employers would have an interest in limiting the cost of healthcare at this point, but seemingly they don't. They prefer a political economy where workers are totally dependent on their jobs to be able to obtain health insurance or to obtain healthcare and you know, have their family not, you know, die whenever anyone gets sick.
That was literally what I was going to say. So I'm glad we're on the same page.
I would say so the more I work on this, the more I think there's a strong parallels between healthcare and higher education. And I'll conclude by saying the following, which is when I was in graduate school for economics 15 years ago now, alas, when Andrew and I first met, I would say the consensus among economists was pretty much the U.S. healthcare system is really good. It's very innovative. The fact that it doesn't cover anyone is the price that you have, the fact that it doesn't cover everyone is the price that you have to pay for having the best healthcare system in the world. You know, we could have a European social democratic healthcare system that would be much lower quality and provide a minimum level of care to everyone. And like the trade-off that we have decided to make is not that. Now, the consensus among economists is pretty much not even close to that. It is the U.S. healthcare system sucks. There's market power everywhere. The providers are out of control. And, you know, we pay way too much for way too low quality that people can't access. So, you know, there's disagreement among economists is, you know, who's at fault, what's the right policy response, but nobody in, you know, outside, like, people who are, I mean, even the people who are like on the payroll of some stakeholders in the healthcare system always point the finger at other ones for the problem. Nobody is saying like, oh, you know, this is a great system. What are you whining about anymore?
Right.
As they were 15 years ago in higher education. We haven't gotten there yet in economics, but I'm pretty sure we will in the not too distant future. That is 5 years ago when I started doing, or I mean, I guess now it's like more like 7-8 years ago when I started doing higher education student debt research, you know, the party line among economists was higher education is really good. Definitely go to college. You will get a payoff in the labor market. Any amount of student debt is worth taking on to pay for it. If you can't pay back your student loans, that's because you made the wrong choice about which institution to go to or which subject to major in. But the higher education system works. And anyone who's like, oh, cancel my student loans, they're just whining because they don't want to pay back their student loans. I don't think we're there anymore. We haven't, you know, we certainly haven't settled on a new consensus about the economics of higher education, but that point of view that of, you know, kind of rose tinted glasses, everything is hunky dory. That's not viable. And I think, you know, we're kind of getting to a world where at least the policy people kind of follow as usual, what the general public has already decided, which is the higher education system is deeply fucked up and I don't want anything to do with it.